This podcast is part of the continuing series of interviews with innovation thought leaders. This week is part one of a two-part interview with Jeffrey Moore. Jeffrey is the author of Crossing the Chasm, Inside the Tornado, The Guerrilla Game, and most recently, Living the Fault Line, each of which deals with a set of challenges on leadership and innovation. Enjoy.
This is the Killer Innovations Podcast with Phil McKinney. Keep in mind that the information and opinions expressed in this podcast are Phil's and Phil's alone, and they don't necessarily reflect those of his past, current, or future employers. Now, here's Phil McKinney.
For today's interview, we're going to be talking with Jeffrey Moore. Jeffrey is pretty well known for all the books you've written, Crossing the Chasm being the one that's kind of, you know, giving you the brand, I think, from the standpoint of the presence in the marketplace. So first of all, Jeffrey, thanks for spending the time with us today.
My pleasure as always, Phil.
So part of what you've been writing about in your books is about, you know, how do you transition from like startups and grow and cross that chasm? So, you know, one of the things we're facing today's economy is really this downturn. What are you seeing from the impact on the current economy on the role of innovation? Are you seeing changes in how corporations and then are making investments or decisions?
Yeah, I think you're seeing changes at both ends of the spectrum. So first of all, when you have a down economy, you all of a sudden get a bigger supply of entrepreneurs, also known as laid off, you know, people. And so you'll see a lot of companies started in this downturn. And that will be great. That'll be great for everybody. And all they really have to do is, frankly, get to $1 million worth of revenue. And like, that's a lot better than where we are today. And there are a lot of ideas that can get to $1 or $2 million that, frankly, a big company would never spend the time on. And so that's, you just get this incredibly early or kind of seed candidates, if you will, that's really exciting. The venture community is all over that. And a lot of these ventures, by the way, don't even need venture capital. You just say, no, I've got a computer or I've got a technology, I'm going to go after it. At the other end of the spectrum, the large companies are under, their first pressure is cut costs, but their second pressure is take share. And so to take share, you do have to do something that your competitors aren't doing. Now, it may not be technology innovation, it may be marketing innovation, it may be some kind of operational innovation, but you're going to be doing something.
Right. And so here's the challenges is those, you know, there's some corporations who maintain their innovation investment even in the downturn, and then there's others who are kind of into this, you know, got to squeeze the bubble, you know, get the money out. How should those corporations really think about it? You know, listeners to this podcast are typically the people who are running the innovation teams in corporations around, and they're having a hard time justifying to their management to, like, not cut the innovation. What would be the message that you think they should be delivering to their senior management?
Well, it's an important thing. So there's, at any given time, you're playing a portfolio game between the stuff that's in the far future, the stuff that's in the near future, and the stuff that's driving the current engine. And there's no question in a downturn that you're going to reallocate at the margin that portfolio. We actually don't see companies necessarily sacrificing their far future investments because they've always find a way to fund something. What they end up doing, however, is marginalizing their near-term innovation, onboarding the innovation, taking the hit to the current quarter or the current four quarters. And that's not really necessarily the innovation lab. It's when you're trying to get it from the lab into the division, that's where the problems happen.
Well, and here's a challenge, right? Transitioning technologies from long-range research into near-term products, the research area has only such, the arm reach only so far.
Right.
The product groups want something that they can start shipping right away.
Right.
And you end up with this gap in the middle.
Hence chasms.
Right.
And we call this problem crossing the chasm inside the belly of a whale because you have this huge enterprise, right? And there's this huge gap. Or sometimes we call it the horizon two gap. And so if you look at who's been successful with that gap, it's not been large corporations. It's been the venture community. The venture community gets credit for all the really squirrely, far-out innovations, but the truth is many of those came from corporate labs. Corporate labs are at least as good, if not better, at doing what I would call far-out innovations as anybody. But the structure of bringing a business to materiality, and in a big corporation, a material business has probably got to be close to $1 billion, right? Mm-hmm. Well, that's a big, long journey. And until you get to some material size, it's very hard for the corporation to even know how to deal with you.
Right.
And when you start making demands on that corporation, they kind of look at you like, what the heck are you doing?
Mm-hmm.
But the most demanding time in the gestation of a company is probably from $10 million to $100 million. So it needs all kinds of special attention. So who's been good at that? Well, the venture community's been good at that. And so what we're looking at now is saying, How can, what can the established enterprise take from the venture community, and what, frankly, does it have to leave behind?
Right.
Because the financial models don't work in the enterprise, but exactly. there are some organizational ideas and some are very helpful.
So if you had to boil down the characteristics of companies who've done the successful, what would be kind of the boiled down characteristics that you've seen?
Well, I everybody always talks about whenever you're doing something a little bit off the map, you need executive sponsorship. And so the kind of executive sponsorship you need is a CEO and a board who's saying, look, this is a portfolio allocation problem, which and what we've tried to do is get people to have three buckets, not two. It used to be there were two buckets. That's either like the innovators or the optimizers, right?
Right.
And that's too far apart from each other. So there's an intermediate bucket, and it turns out it's more like an hourglass. You sort of think of it, people always did innovation as a funnel. So you had like, well, I've got a gazillion ideas and I'm going to winnow them down to, you know, some dozen of possibilities and I'm going to get a few viable businesses out of the other end. We think it's actually more like an hourglass, which is you have a gazillion ideas. If for any big business, you have a gazillion resources, but the ability to actually get a business from idea to real material contribution is a very, very narrow path to go through. And so we think people, we were trying to encourage people to rethink the dynamics. You and I were talking earlier about the antibodies. That is a total natural response of an organism to an invader.
Right.
And so you got to kind of neutralize it.
Yeah, and it's a challenge, right? And, you know, actually I did a tweet a couple weeks ago where the tweet was, you know, be prepared to go to battle for your ideas because the corporate bodies will attack anything outside the norm. It got the most replies. I got more emails on that tweet, and everybody's like, "Amen! I'm fighting that battle today." You know,
truth is, it is a totally appropriate. I mean, the immune system is an evolutionary response to invaders, right?
Exactly.
And the challenge is what we call the Horizon One team, the team that's responsible for making the current fiscal year commitments, is jealous of its resources. In fact, we'd like more resources because it's made a stretch commitment that, frankly, it's going to be challenging to make, and particularly in this economy. And when the innovator comes in and says, I need real sales responsiveness, or I need my own R&D thing, or I need professional services to be in Moscow tomorrow, and they're saying, well, how much money is that? You know, how much revenue is associated with that? And the answer is, well, none yet. And the guy's going, I can't give you that. And so you have this situation where whereas in a VC-backed company, you're darn right, I can give you that. So that's the difference.
Right. Talk a little bit about, you mentioned earlier about the fact that during this downturn, we're seeing a lot of businesses get started. And actually, if you think about a lot of companies that got started, a lot of them did get started during, whether it was the Depression of the 30s or previous recessions, because you do find people who basically had the excuse taken away from them for finally going out and doing their dream, right? You got laid off or whatever. Okay, the excuse is gone. Now, you know, jump into the deep end. What are some of the guidelines you would give some of those entrepreneurs when trying to, you know, validate what the ideas they're working on? Because sometimes, you know, and I'm sure you do it, I get emails from people, you know, asking, oh, they got this great idea, what's my thought on it? And you read some of these and you go, holy smokes, I don't think I'd be betting my 401k on...
Perpetual motion is normally not the one that works. So anti-gravity. So what we talk a lot about is saying at every stage in an innovation, including, you know, before you've put pen to paper, you want to expose it to market forces, not to internal, you have, as a matching to your internal ideation. Mm-hmm. So what that means is, and for an entrepreneur, this is really important. The first piece of, you want to get a piece of work as fast as you can. A, because you're out of work. And B, because you also want to test this idea as early as possible. So typically, no matter what you're inventing, whether it's a product or a technology or a service, the first piece of work you get is a project. And you, what you do is you go to a visionary customer or a customer who's in real trouble one way or the other, they're motivated, and you say, we think there's this possibility and we think it solves this kind of problem and it looks like you have that problem. Would you like to work on it? And the guy says, yeah, but I'm not a VC. I need you to solve my problem. And so you kind of sign up. It's almost like a consulting project, right? Mm-hmm. You sign up for that first one. What's great about that is you can get a stream of revenue coming in, but much more importantly, you get a stream of reality coming in.
Mm-hmm.
And so you don't get caught up in that sort of, the danger, I think, in a downturn, particularly now in our sort of internet isolated age, is you can stay in your room for many, many days in a row thinking you're making progress because, you know, you're working on technology and you're on the internet and all this stuff is happening. And I get scared if you go very far down that path without having a customer.
Mm-hmm.
Even if the customer, and initially the customer may be a nonprofit customer. It may be, you know what, I can't pay you anything, but I will sponsor this effort.
Right, yeah. So you think about, you know, you and I have had this conversation in the past, right, about, you know, where's the future go? So what, if you had to look at a couple of years, what do you think is kind of the interesting things that are going to be, that are happening?
On Mondays I hang out at More David Adventures, and so I'm a venture partner there. And so the first observation I would make is, well, what's the venture community doing? And interestingly, for guys of your and my generation, they're not as interested in computing as they've been all of my life. So it's not that they aren't investing in computing, but at the margin, what's happened particularly in enterprise IT, but in consumer IT as well, the established corporations increasingly have the advantage. Even if they can't invent it, they can at least buy it to scale it, because they're already at such great scale. And so it's hard to get a venture return from computing the way it used to be, create a whole new computing company. But in life sciences, if you take applying computing to life sciences, which is incredibly exciting, and particularly if you think of DNA as a computer, that's even more exciting, or applying computing to high clean tech and all the clean tech nano. So we were talking about nano a bunch of years ago. Well, what nano has become is life sciences and clean tech.
Right.
Because it's all nano, right? And so I think the nouns have changed. The verbs haven't changed. We're still doing innovation. And you said, you're on the Roche thing, right?
Right.
So you're here at a drug company, you're here at HP at a computing company, but as you said, the conversations sound identical.
Yeah, it is. You just change out the terms, whether I'm doing blood glucose meters or I'm doing inkjet printhead cartridges, sounds the exact same.
So I'm learning about new nouns. I'm learning a lot of new nouns, but the verbs are the same.
Right. If you look back on your history, I mean, if you think about back, when was Crossing the Chasm published?
In 91.
It's got long legs. It still resonates, you know, people are still talking about it. It gets a lot of press inside. So congratulations on kind of that breakthrough thinking that's kind of has driven the thinking for a lot of companies that have started. So what's the new project for Jeffrey Moore? What are you working on now?
Well, so if you look at from 91 to here, what happened was the 90s for me and my colleagues was largely about this incredible wave of categorical innovation around the client server and then around the internet and around the consumerization of IT. I mean, there were just these massive waves of change. After the tech bubble burst, and in this decade, our attention shifted to the larger enterprise, A, because they were a viable customer base.
Mm-hmm.
But those challenges were so different, and they're the challenges that we're talking about right now, which is how, if you have an enormously successful franchise, it will generate this immune system problem we're talking about. Yet at the same time, it needs new blood. It needs a transfusion of new stuff. So we used the antibody metaphor for a long time, but we weren't able to translate it into we couldn't figure out, well, so what's the injection that overcomes the thing? And so this decade we've been working a lot, and the most recent book is called Dealing with Darwin, and the subtitle's about how great companies innovate at every stage of their evolution. And this whole we're really fascinated with this problem of how can you suppress the immune system long enough to let the new thing get in and get going, because at some point, it becomes part of your flesh and blood, and then you're hugely happy that you're existing in a large institution because you can operate at scale.
Right, you get the advantage of all the resources.
Exactly.
So the question is, what's the role of leadership to get over that kind of the corporate antibody problem?
So I think that the deal is the leadership has to have a tripartite model, not a binary model. As I said, when we encountered the problem originally, it was always something against us versus them. It was we the maverick few and them the Borg, right? and the thing is, you have to have, and it's a, so the metaphors that we're using now are much more like child, adolescent, and adult. So there's still children and there's still adults, but actually adults and children get along reasonably well. Adolescents don't get along with anybody.
Right.
And it's at the adolescent stage of the business that the enterprise kills it, not at the child stage. So that means what you got to do is there's a whole set of protocols, organizational ideas, metrics, staffing ideas, where you have to have a temporary suspension of adult rules, but they're not this, but it's not the same as kid rules.
Right.
Because adolescents, you know, do weird things, and they take more risk than you want them to, and they consume a lot of resources. But on the other
talking
hand...
talking about my kids.
Well, yeah, that would be our
or
kids.
Or my kids, yeah.
So therefore, you can't treat them as children, but you also can't treat them as adults. And the problem with most corporate systems is they only really have two modes. It's either on or off.
Right.
So you can get a hall pass for innovation for quite a long time.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of like being a kid.
Right.
But as soon as you're trying to become material, then all the adults come to the room and they're looking at this guy who's like 13 years old saying, "Where's your 401k?" And you know, it's like, "Well, I'm 13.
One of the common emails I get is a lot of people, you know, coming out of high school, going into college, they're really fascinated about building an entire career around innovation, right? It's kind of becoming, and I get, and I'm sure you do too, get this request for, what college should I go to?
Right.
You know, right. what would be your advice? I mean, right. I'm on the record as being kind of this really strong proponent that we're kind of in this fundamental shift from kind of this information knowledge economy to the creative economy, and that the traditional skills-based learning approach is the playing field for that is leveled on a global scale, given the quality of the universities and education on a global basis. And then it's really about individuals' ability to innovate and be creative. So what would be your advice to those people who are coming in? These are the high school kids going into college, college kids going to, thinking about their graduate degree. What would be your advice?
And by the way, so let me just first of all re-endorse and reinforce what you just said, which is, I do think the skills economy has gone global. And if you look at what differentiates particularly the United States from other countries, it's our risk-taking ability. It's frankly the ability that we can fail fast and recover.
Mm-hmm.
Most cultures cannot recover from failure gracefully. You're dishonored, basically, and you're essentially disenfranchised. So back to now, if a person says, "I'm really passionate about innovation," you're not going to learn a lot at school about innovation. In any school, I don't care how good the grad school is. Now, the thing that will happen is if you go to a top name school, you will be surrounded with other bright people. You'll learn a lot from the other bright people about innovation, but you're not going to take a class in innovation that's going to change your life. At least, mm-hmm. I don't think you will. What will change your life is the first time you take a risk. And if you think about being a student, you haven't taken a risk yet. Fundamentally, I mean, you go to school, you go to class, what's the risk? The first time that you do something, whether it's, you know, when I was growing up, it was, well, would you be willing to go to Mississippi to work for voter civil rights? Would you be willing to march against the Vietnam War? Would you be willing to? The first time you take a personal risk, which takes you outside of your support zone, you're going to learn about innovation.
Mm-hmm.
And until you do that, you're not.
And actually, you know, and every year I talk to the group of interns here at HP, and they've either read the blog or listened to the podcast, and they've heard me make this speech, and a group of them are all in the middle of their MBA classes, and they're like, "Oh my God, I'm in my, should I be my MBA?" I'm like, "Whoa, don't quit your MBA, because I don't want your parents coming to kill me." But, you know, one of the advices I do give, if your heart's set, and if you come from an engineering technical background, and your heart's set going to master's, go get your master's of fine arts, because it's a risk. You may not know how to put a piece of paper, a pen, you know, a drawing on a piece of paper.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, because if you go to an MBA, okay, I'm enhancing the skills you already have versus go do something so radically different and get out of the, and switch sides of your brain.
Well, I was going to say, it's not an accident that you are doing what you're doing or that I'm doing what I'm doing. Because both of us, for whatever reason, by constitution or education or both, have real passions on the left and the right side of our brain.
Mm-hmm.
And what you discover about innovation is that it's a ping pong match. And you can't play it from, there are people that try to play it only from the right side of the brain, they end up sounding like new age idiots. And there are people that try to play it from the left hand of their brains and they sound like, you know, uber scientists that are going to, you know, re-engineer the world. And the truth is it's ping pong all the time. And so if you feel like you're underdeveloped on either side of your brain, that's probably the side of the brain. If you're passionate about innovation, now I think it should be clear, innovation is part of a larger system too. And sometimes people think of innovation, well, that's the frosting of the cake. And I don't want to eat the cake. I just want to eat the frosting, right?
Right.
It's like, no. If you're going to be a successful innovator, you got to go through the entire cycle, including the drudgery of innovation and the struggles and whatever. Or otherwise, you're frankly not going to be very useful. You're going to be... It reminds me, I think a bunch of people think of innovation as kind of like corporate entertainment. And, you know, it's no risk. I'm going to just innovate and I'll be brilliant. And as soon as it requires any real struggle, well, I'll give it to somebody who's operational because I'm the innovator. It's like, no, thank you. So we use the word entrepreneur a lot in venture rather than innovator because the entrepreneur word says, well, you better be an innovator or you can't get in the door. But if you can't fight a street fight, you can't get out the door.
Thanks for listening to this week's podcast. Please send your feedback. Particularly, I'm interested in hearing your thoughts on doing these kinds of interviews. The objective is to give you a broader exposure to others that are out there creating killer innovations. If you found this podcast interesting and you want to connect with other innovators, join the network. There's killer innovation groups now in existence over on LinkedIn and Facebook and a variety of the social sites. Also, feel free to follow me over on Twitter. Just do a follow, Phil McKinney. Also, pay it forward. For those of you that are regular listeners of the podcast, you know that my sole objective in the podcast is to pay it forward as a return to my early mentors. And when I asked them how to pay it back, they told me later in my career to pay it forward to others. All I ask is that you pay it forward. Thanks for the time out of your busy schedule. Look forward to talking to you real soon. Bye-bye. Thank you.